Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for October 15th, 2020. We are broadcasting this week from the Whites of Their Eyes division here at the Georgia Historical Society. This week's guest on the podcast is Rick Atkinson, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the new book, The British Are Coming, The War for America, Volume 1, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777, published by Henry Holt. Before we get to the interview, however, let's begin with a quick look at the ever-popular This Week in History. On October 15, 1991, 29 years ago, Georgia native Clarence Thomas was confirmed by the U.S. Senate to the Supreme Court. President George H.W. Bush appointed Thomas to the U.S. Court of Appeals in 1989, and 2 years later, when Thurgood Marshall retired, Bush nominated Thomas for the High Court. Civil rights groups opposed him as unworthy to follow Marshall, and former employee Anita Hill accused Thomas of sexual harassment. Clarence Thomas gained his seat after the Senate confirmed him by the closest vote in the 20th century, 52-48. On October 16, 1859, 161 years ago, abolitionist John Brown made his famous raid on the U.S. arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. The event made him a martyr to the anti-slavery cause and was instrumental in heightening sectional animosities that led to the American Civil War. Brown and his group of 16 white and 5 black men held out against the local militia, but finally surrendered to a contingency of troops under the command of Colonel Robert E. Lee. Brown himself was wounded, and 10 of his followers, including 2 of his sons, were killed. He was tried for murder, slave insurrection, and treason against the state, and was convicted and hanged on December 2, 1859, at the age of 59, in what is now Charlestown, West Virginia. He is buried at the John Brown Farm in North Elba, New York. On October 17, 1938, 82 years ago, Robert Craig Knievel was born, and if you grew up in the 1970s like me, you wanted to be Evel Knievel. We all jumped our bikes over anything we could think of, just like him. Clad in his trademark star-spangled red, white, and blue jumpsuits, Evel Knievel made more than 300 jumps during his career, and claimed to have broken nearly every bone in his body. In 1967, he performed his most famous stunt, a spectacular jump over the fountains at Caesar's Palace Hotel in Las Vegas. You can find it on YouTube if you've never seen it, in which he botched the landing, fractured his skull, and suffered a concussion that kept him in the hospital for a month afterwards. He also famously made a failed attempt in 1974 to soar over the Snake River Canyon in Idaho using a rocket-powered motorcycle called the Sky Cycle. Evel Knievel died November 30, 2007 at age 69 and is buried in Mountain View Cemetery in Butte, Montana, where he was born. On October 18, 1735, 285 years ago, a group of Scottish Highlanders sailed from Inverness, Scotland, bound for Georgia. They disembarked on the northern bank of the Altamaha River, where they founded New Inverness, later named Darien, 60 miles south of Savannah. The Scots had been recruited by General James Oglethorpe to provide a buffer between the English colony and the Spanish in Florida. During the conflict with Spain in 1740, known as the War of Jenkins' Ear, the Scots served with Oglethorpe at the Siege of St. Augustine, and they played a critical role in the Spanish defeat at Fort Frederica on St. Simon's Island in 1742, which solidified English claims on the North American continent. On October 19, 1781, 239 years ago, during the American Revolution, Britain's Lord Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, Virginia, handing a huge victory to American General George Washington, and effectively ending the military phase of the Revolution and assuring America's independence. On October 20th, 1977, 43 years ago, a plane carrying the rock group Lynyrd Skynyrd crashed and killed singer Ronnie Van Zant, guitarist Steve Gaines, and his older sister backup singer Cassie Gaines. Following a performance in Greenville, South Carolina, the band boarded a chartered Convair CV-240 bound for Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where they were scheduled to appear at LSU the following night. After running out of fuel, the pilots attempted an emergency landing before crashing in a heavily forested area 5 miles northeast of Gillsburg, Mississippi. Lynyrd Skynyrd was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006. And finally, on October 21st, 1520, 500 years ago, explorer Ferdinand Magellan and 3 Spanish ships entered the strait later named for him, the Straits of Magellan, sailing between the mainland tip of South America and the island of Tierra del Fuego between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Magellan, a Portuguese explorer sailing for Spain, was the first European to navigate the strait, and it took him 39 days to get through it. Lying entirely within what are now Chilean territorial waters, except for its easternmost extremity touched by Argentina, it is 350 miles long and 2 to 20 miles wide. Magellan's expedition eventually completed the first circumnavigation of the world. Although the strait follows a somewhat tortuous course among numerous islands and channels and has a cold, foggy climate, the Straits of Magellan was an important sailing ship route before the Panama Canal was completed in 1914 and shortened the Atlantic-Pacific Passage by several thousand miles. One of the things I want to do before I die is travel through the Straits of Magellan. And that's This Week in History. And now to our interview this week. My special guest is Rick Atkinson. Rick is the author of The Liberation Trilogy, a narrative history of the liberation of Europe in World War II. The first volume, entitled An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942 to 1943, published in 2002, received the 2003 Pulitzer Prize in History. The second volume, The Day of Battle, The War in Sicily and Italy, 1943 to 1944, was published in 2007. And the final volume, The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe, 1944 to 1945, was published in 2013, and the entire trilogy was hailed quite rightly as a monumental achievement. In addition to his historical writing, Rick Atkinson worked as a reporter, foreign correspondent, and senior editor for 2 decades at The Washington Post. His last assignments were covering the 101st Airborne during the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and writing about roadside bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2007. In addition to the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for History, Rick also won the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service and the 1982 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. In 2019, Rick was named a Vincent J. Dooley Distinguished Teaching Fellow by the Georgia Historical Society, an honor that recognizes national leaders in the field of history as both writers and educators whose research has enhanced or changed the way the public understands the past. While he was in Savannah, I talked to him about his latest book, The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. Published by Henry Holt in 2019. This is the first volume of his intended Revolution Trilogy, a history of the American Rebellion through 1783. Here's Rick Atkinson. Rick Atkinson, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Stan.
We're here to talk about your new book, The British Are Coming, which is the first in the Revolution Trilogy. How do you approach a subject this broad? You wrote 3 books about World War II, and clearly were immersed in your subject, but this is a really big switching gears. How does somebody who has always been interested in the Revolution, as I know you have been, what's the first thing you do when you come to a subject this big?
When I was finishing the World War II trilogy, having spent 15 years looking at the American role in the liberation of Europe and thinking about what I wanted to do next, the obvious thing would have been to pivot to the Pacific and to do for that theater what I'd done for the Mediterranean and Western Europe. And I just didn't have the heart for it, partly because I would have had to start the war over again at Pearl Harbor or even earlier. And so thinking about what it was that I wanted to do next, I kept going back to a subject that has beguiled me since I was a kid, and that's the story of our founding and the American Revolution particularly. You know, the first thing that I do when I start out on it, once I've committed myself to the subject and got a publisher to commit themselves with me, is to try and take a big step back and read sort of foundational works that will give me a sense of the framework that I'm going to be working with. And then I start immediately plunging into archives. I think that, you know, if you wait until you've read all the secondary material and then start looking at primary material, first of all, that's not much fun. And second, I don't think it's necessary. I think actually when you can immerse yourself without knowing as much as you're going to know about a subject, immerse yourself in some of the original documents and the, you know, primary sources that tease out stories that may not be well known. So that's what I do, and I plunge into, for this book, archives in London. I went to Windsor Castle for a month.
Talk about that.
Well, the papers of our last king, George III, are kept at Windsor because Queen Elizabeth owns them. She owns the papers of all four Georges who became king in the 18th and 19th centuries. And she decided, I think in late 2015, that she was going to open them up to the public. She was going to have them digitized and cataloged.
They had not been opened before.
You know, there had been official correspondence had been published. But for the most part, in this case, there are 350,000 pages, most of it unpublished, most of it belonging to George III because he was king for 60 years. And they didn't know what they had. Nobody had ever really been through this stuff. They'd been through the official correspondence between George and Lord North, his prime minister, for example, and that has been published. But George was a great list maker, among other things, and you find lists that he would make of his regiments in America, or theater reviews that he would write, or recipes for insecticide, very odd stuff, letters to his kids, correspondence with Charlotte, his queen.
Mm. And he had a lot of kids.
15 kids. She had the kids. Mm-hmm. He was the dad. And he's a good father. You see this in the correspondence. So I applied for a little fellowship to get in, and I was one of the first allowed in. And the papers are kept in the garret of the Round Tower, the structure within Windsor Castle, begun by William the Conqueror in the 11th century. And every day I would show my badge at the Henry VIII gate and show it again at the Norman gate and then climb 102 stone steps and 21 wooden stairs to the top of the Round Tower, and that's where the papers are, in these gorgeous, oversized red binders. And you really have a tactile sense of being in George's presence. He was his own secretary until late in life when he began to go blind. He wrote not only his correspondence himself and all those lists, he made copies himself.
And they're kept in archivally controlled, climate controlled. You hear this on top of a tower. You think, is it cold and damp up there?
Yeah, it is cold and damp. you know, it's on the best paper money can buy in the 18th century.
Yeah,
with the best ink that can be made in the 18th century, and they're in these big, oversized red binders that the Brits use for their official papers. But, you know, there had been a terrible fire at Windsor Castle some years ago. Mm-hmm. It did not get to this part of Windsor, but there was concern about the perishability of this stuff. And again, they did not know what was in there. And so, you know, it was a great privilege to spend a month doing that. And that really immersed me in the world of George and British politics and what it was George thought he was doing by waging war for 8 years against his own people across 3,000 miles of open ocean. And you really do get a sense from those papers of, you know, why they're doing this, why they're waging war. So, I find that immersing myself in primary materials like that is really important to try and transport myself and then eventually the reader back into a period like that.
Was his handwriting hard to decipher?
Happily, no. He had good handwriting. As you know, Stan, it can be the bane of anybody working in primary materials from the 18th century. Some of the handwriting is absolutely indecipherable. Henry Clinton, who was the British commander-in-chief for longer than any other British general during the Revolution, he was the commander-in-chief for 4 years. his handwriting is, it doesn't look like it's in English. You think, you know, what is this, Sanskrit? His papers are in Ann Arbor. And, you know, when you find someone who has good, legible handwriting, you are grateful for it. And George is one of those people.
And one of the things you point out about George III's correspondence that you comment on, I'd never read anywhere, was his habit of precisely down to the minute, not only dating his correspondence, but saying 11:18 p.m., for instance.
Yeah. Yeah, he's an obsessive compulsive guy. There's no question that he's a little OCD, and he does have this habit of not only dating his correspondence, but he'll write, you know, 11:12 a.m. September 17th, 1778, or you know, 9:15 p.m.
Very unusual for that period.
It is unusual, and you find that his lackeys tend to pick up the habit, too. So you find, I was amused to see that that George Germain, Lord Germain, who becomes the American secretary, he was a British general, he'd been disgraced in the Seven Years' War, he rehabilitates himself, and the next thing you know, he's basically running the war. He's kind of the Robert McNamara for the Brits for that war. And I see that Germain begins to not only date, but also to put timestamps on his correspondence to the king also. So it was habit-forming.
And I you have to believe that it humanizes these people too, in a way, right? We've all heard about George III. He's the villain of the Revolution, but to sit there and hold his correspondence in Windsor Castle, it must have made him human in a way that probably nothing else could.
You know, that's exactly right. And understanding his relationship with those 15 kids, and you know, he'd married this obscure drab German princess, Charlotte, as in Charlottesville, Virginia, Charlotte, North Carolina. She learns to play God Save the King on the harpsichord when she's making the voyage from Germany to England. They marry 6 hours after they meet. He has the marriage bedroom decorated with 700 yards of blue damask and large basins of goldfish, because, you know, nothing says I love you like a bowl of goldfish. And this does humanize him. This is, you know, I have a fondness for him, even though I recognize that as an American, he's sort of the arch enemy. And he's got some terribly wrong conceptions about the war he's waging, about Americans, about America generally. And yet I find him impossible to disdain or simply dismiss as a reactionary autocrat. He's more complex than that. He's more interesting than that.
He's a bibliophile.
Well, he loves his 60,000 books become the basis for the British Library. He's interested in everything from agronomy. They call him Farmer George. Found a treatise on manures. To astronomy. He's a great supporter of the arts. He's a pretty good musician himself. He's a man of parts. He supports British enterprises in what's the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. He's very important in that. And, you know, he's not to be dismissed as some nitwit, not the clown who minces across the stage in Hamilton every night. He's more, he's a more formidable adversary than that, for one thing.
And the portrayal in The Madness of King George, as brilliant as that portrayal is, and I know that's later in his life after.
Yeah.
After the colonies are lost, but you don't take to that too kindly either, I think.
Well, I mean, the madness is real, but it doesn't strike until late in life, really. He's got a couple of episodes, and it's not clear what was wrong with him. He has some kind of it was thought for a while it was porphyria, which is a hereditary disease that can cause hallucinations, and it's terrible. And now there's a belief by a number of scholars that it probably was not porphyria, but whatever it was, he'd had a couple of episodes relatively early in his life, but it's really not until well into the 19th century that the madness of King George really becomes madness. He becomes, you know, he can no longer be king. They have to kind of move him aside, and it wrecks his old age. His last 10 years are horrible, just horrible. You wouldn't wish it on anybody. But that is not a factor in the period we're talking about. He's at the peak of his powers in 1775 to 1783. He's a relatively young man still. He's physically robust. He gets lots of exercise. He eats pretty well for an 18th century monarch. There's no indication at all that he's got any mental or physical impairment.
I was really interested, not to dwell too long on George III, but I was really interested that you said, didn't know this either. He never traveled beyond England. You said not to Ireland, to the continent, not even to Scotland, and certainly not America.
Yeah, and I think it says something about his constricted view of what's happening in geopolitical terms. Yeah, you would think that he would at least venture to Scotland at some time in his long life, and he doesn't do that. And his ministers also never travel to the New World. So they have no firsthand knowledge of what has happened in America over the past 150 years. Mm. They don't really understand in a granular way that two peoples deriving from a common heritage have really grown apart. They've been sundered by conflicting values and by conflicting visions of what the world can be. And he doesn't get that at all. He just doesn't see it. He really is an imperialist in the sense that the colonies exist to produce raw materials for the mother country and to buy finished goods from the mother country. Mm-hmm. That's his view of the way the world should work. And if you're against that, then you're against him and you're against the crown. You're against the will of Parliament, which he takes very seriously. And you're against the will of God. He's very religious and he believes that this is the universe that God has constructed. And he is personally offended by the antipathy that many Americans have toward this comfortable British world that he inhabits.
Mm-hmm. So you read broadly in secondary sources. You know where the primary sources are. When you read the secondary sources, did you say, okay, I see where my niche is going to be and where I'm going to fit into all of this, or did you just say, you know what, I'm going to tell my story and let it lay or fall where it wants to?
Yeah, it's more the latter. At the risk of being arrogant, I do believe that the greatest events in American history are bottomless. That people will be writing biographies of Abraham Lincoln 500 years from now. Mm-hmm. People will be writing about World War II, and people will be writing about the American Revolution and George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and the other large figures of that time. So, I certainly acknowledge and am grateful for the tremendous scholarship that's been done for 200 years. Some of the finest historians in our national history have labored in this vineyard. But I believe I've got a voice that's my own. I think I've got a storytelling capacity that's my own. And I also believe that I am enough of an indefatigable researcher that I can tease out things that even if you're well-read in this period, you may not know, and can stitch it together in a way that makes it a narrative. And even though you know how it's going to end, I want you to forget that you know how it's going to end. I want you to believe that you're kind of reading this story for the first time. And that's how I approach it. I don't look for a niche. I don't look for a thesis to forward or a thesis, somebody else's thesis to demolish. I am fundamentally a narrative writer, and therefore I'm looking for a story, and I'm looking to tell that story as best I can.
Two points to that. There's a great tradition in American literature, really, going back to George Bancroft for the multi-volume history. And some of the best biographies you and I were discussing earlier, Douglas Hawthorne Freeman, mm-hmm. Carl Sandburg's Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But you don't see those much anymore. Did you, when you set out to write the Liberation Trilogy, did you have to convince your publisher that this was something that people would want to read? Three volumes on whatever, or
yeah.
However you sketched it out originally. Did you get any pushback at all on this?
I did not. I've had the same editor for 32 years now, John Sterling, one of the great editors, and one of my closest friends. We've done seven books together. And when we talked about the Liberation Trilogy, and it was in 1998 when the germ of an idea turned into a real endeavor. I conceived of it as a trilogy. I was thinking very much about Shelby Foote and Bruce Catton. Mm-hmm. I'm aware of those precedents, aware of their ambition, and trying to be ambitious too. And I conceived of that as I said, look, this is a triptych. This is a three-paneled work of art here. And it falls beautifully because the first panel, the first volume, is North Africa. That's where the liberation of Europe begins. And then they move 100 miles across the Mediterranean to Sicily and Italy. And that's the second panel. That's the second volume. And then the third volume, Rome falls on June 4th, 1944. And, of course, the invasion of Normandy is 2 days later. And that last volume is the consequential campaign from Normandy to the end of the war in Europe. So John saw it right away and said, "Yeah, well, we're wasting time. This is going to take a while. Get to it." And then, you know, I don't believe that a trilogy is necessarily the appropriate form for every work of history. For one thing, you're committing yourself to a lot of work. But when I began looking at this story and thinking about it, I was initially thinking one volume, and then it became two volumes. I didn't want one volume that was 1,000 pages long. It's not marketable, for one thing, these days. But then as I was looking closer at the story and seeing how the story cleaves and how you can unfold it similar to the way the Liberation Trilogy unfolded, it turned into a three-volume proposal. And again, John Sterling in it at the beginning said, okay, I see that. Let's do it. Get started. And so, now I'm committed.
Well, and you mentioned Shelby Foote and Bruce Catton. I was going to ask you if you had anybody that you read growing up or anybody you looked to as kind of, if not a mentor, but somebody who sort of that you I wouldn't say aspired to write like, but those people who inspired you, I guess.
Yeah, I think Shelby Foote is somebody that I really admire. Now, he wrote three volumes on the Civil War, famously. It's 3,000 pages. Mm-hmm. There's not a single footnote in any of those 3,000 pages. I don't think you can get away with that today.
Yeah.
His scholarship is very, very solid, and he's a novelist turned into a historian, mm-hmm. a narrative historian. Mm-hmm. But looking at Shelby Foote, and I periodically go back and read the 80 pages on Gettysburg just for inspiration and to see how he structures it and to hear the lyricism of it. I've gone back and reread Stillness and Appomattox by Catton, including the end of that, which is so lyrical and so powerful. But looking particularly at Foote, I thought from the beginning, I'm going to adhere to the standards of scholarship. I'm not an academic. I'm always looking over my shoulder to make sure that the academics aren't after me, because I believe that the standards that they represent are important. And I'm going to stick with him, and I'm going to go the extra mile to annotate and to provide all the information that's necessary to show where this information came from and to show that it's solidly based in rigorous scholarship. So I admire some of these forerunners very much, and I'm grateful to them. In other places, I've certainly found my own way.
I asked you this earlier, I ask you again. I've read and reread and reread the last couple of pages of The Guns at Last Light,
mm-hmm.
but particularly the last paragraph and the last sentence, very moving. Do you know what the last sentence of this trilogy is going to be, or do you literally just write it as we read it, sentence by sentence, and is that how you put that together?
Yeah, I don't know what the last sentence of this trilogy will be. I didn't know the last sentence. I've got a pretty good idea of structurally how they're organized, And I've often got an idea of what the last scene will be. The last sentence, though, the actual prose, I'm making it up as I go along. You know, that last sentence you reminded me earlier that it talks about the fading of that generation, the World War II generation. They're now, what, 500,000 of them still alive out of 16.1 million who were in uniform for America in World War II. And I sort of anticipate when that last World War II soldier is going to leave us, probably sometime in the 2030s. Demographers at the Veterans Administration have a pretty good idea of the decline of the generation. And I actually think when I wrote that, I was thinking of my father. My father, who died last year at the age of 94, was enlisted in the Army in late 1942 at the age of 18, came back from Europe in 1946, went to Penn State, and then went back into the Army and made a career out of it. He was a career infantry officer. And I knew my father was not going to be the last World War II vet, although I really began to wonder whether he was going to outlive everybody, including me. But I think of him as representative of that generation in the sense that, you know, he came of age when the world was coming apart at the seams, volunteered to do what had to be done, and then came back and got on with his life and then was committed enough to the service, and he liked the culture of the Army, so he went back into it. So I do remember writing that last paragraph and thinking specifically of my old man.
And we can talk about the process, and I will if there's time, but I want to talk about this book, this book about the British are coming, the first 2 years of the Revolution, that covers 75 to 77. How many battlefield tours or trips did you go on and as part of your research for this, too? You can't interview veterans here like you probably did for the other one, but you can still walk the ground. And you did that a lot because I saw it in your notes. Talk about that.
Yeah, and the truth is I don't interview veterans much for World War II stuff. Again,
a lot of that's already been done.
Well, a lot of it's been done, and I don't trust 70-year-old memories. My father was quite acute to the end of his life, and I would no more trust what he thinks happened in May of 1944 than I would think he could fly to the moon. I once in a while when you're interviewing somebody, they give you that little brushstroke of detail about what happened 60 or 70 years ago that's absolutely flawless and perfect. But for the most part, I just don't trust it. And the contemporaneous record for World War II is so vast, so enormous, so deep and wide and all the rest of it, including interviews that were done extensively by professional historians with soldiers as they were coming off the battlefield at Hurtgen Forest or the Battle of the Bulge or Normandy, often when they were in hospitals recuperating from wounds. The Army had a program to interview these guys, and all those interviews are available. They're in the National Archives. So there's lots of stuff out there. So that absence didn't really bother me for this. If there were, you know, if George Washington somehow were still alive, let's say he was born in 1732, he would be a real old guy. And I wouldn't trust his memory either about what happened at Monmouth. I do walk the battlefields. I think it's important. I think it's important, particularly as an amateur, that I understand tactically what happened and understand distances and terrain. And even more important than that, that I feel emotionally what the ground has to say to you, because it certainly does speak to you. I did it for World War II battlefields. I've been over all of those battlefields in some cases multiple times. And I do it here, too. I went to Quebec and walked the walls of Quebec. The Americans attacked on New Year's Eve, 1775. The American commander, Montgomery, was killed. Benedict Arnold, his deputy, shot through the knee, badly wounded. And, you know, Quebec is still a fortified city, and you can really have a sense of what it was like and what distances are like and how difficult those walls are.
Did you know exactly where Montgomery fell?
I did. Okay. Yeah. And in fact, there's signage. Yes. And again, that speaks to me emotionally. Montgomery's a guy that I've been living with for a while. And he had been a British Army officer. He'd thrown in his lot with the Americans. He'd emigrated to the U.S., to America, and had married an American. And, you know, he's kind of making his way in life. And all of a sudden he gets caught up in this revolution and they make him a general. He'd been a major in the British Army. And then he's killed. And he's killed in this valiant, doomed attack on Fortress Quebec. And you
in
go
in the snow at night
in this terrible snowstorm, and yes, it's the middle of the night, and it's an attack that's going to collapse quickly, and many of the Americans are going to be killed or captured, and you can't go there and stand on that spot and not feel something. Somebody's speaking to you. You can see where they kept Montgomery's body for years, and it was repatriated in 1819, I think it was, after being in Quebec for a long time. It was a national holiday in America. Look at all the Montgomerys we've got in America, Montgomery County outside of Washington, where I live, Montgomery, Alabama. It's a long list, and it gives you some idea of Montgomery's really the first martyr. So, yeah, I go to those battlefields for a variety of purposes. Now, it's hard in places like New York. New York doesn't look like New York looked in 1776. The shorelines are completely different. The shorelines of Boston are totally different. Landfill has changed the terrain, the topography, the shorelines utterly. So you have to have maps and you have to have an imagination. But again, I think if you go to Greenwood Cemetery, which is in Brooklyn, and it was created after the Revolution, but that's where a lot of the fighting in Brooklyn took place. And you can feel the agony. And I think agony is an important thing to understand. It's war. It's war. And it means war always means young men dying young, often dying alone, dying in pain, dying to no obvious purpose in some cases because they've been sent into battle under stupid circumstances. And the ground will speak to you about those things.
Did you go to Bunker Hill?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And again, Bunker Hill, you know, it's got this big obelisk on top of it, so which was not there. I have a friend who's a college history professor, and one of his students asked, why is it that so many American Civil War battles were fought on national parkland?
Well, and because of you, this is one of the things I mentioned to you earlier. I know the Bunker Hill happened on a Saturday. Right. One of the things that you do in this book, and I don't know if it's part of your journalistic training, it spoke to me. It's a real temporal sense in this book. Well, you will say, June 17th, 1775, they awoke on that Saturday morning. And then as you tell the story, you're telling it in terms of days. By Monday morning, this happened. On Tuesday afternoon, which is how we live our lives. Most historians just keep dropping in dates. There's never a sense of the passage of time and the way that we know it. You made a real decision to do that. I think.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's my equivalent of the date time stamps that George III uses on his correspondence. Yeah, I keep a period calendar next to my desk, and I'm very aware of the day of the week. It's important, among other things, that Sunday is really important to these religious New Englanders particularly. So it's important to know when it's Sunday. It's a day of rest and worship and so on for many of them. But I do think that, it is how we live our lives. We think of today as being Thursday and tomorrow will be Friday, and we think of it in those terms rather than the specific date. We think of the rhythms of the week as a 7-day week. And I hadn't really thought about it until you mentioned it, Stan, but I do think that it's part of the narrative flow that I use.
I want to quote you here. You say, the narrative historian's task is to harness scholarship and lucid storytelling, to bring back the dead, to breathe life into a figure that can seem impossibly remote to a 21st century reader. You've said that your goal is to restore, you talked about this, the emotional connection between the founders and today's readers. And I have to tell you, reading this, you're right. You know how the you know what the outcome is, but the despair that I felt when the army was retreating across New Jersey in the fall of 1776 was palpable.
Yeah,
real.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a real nadir, and Washington writes to his brother, I think the game is pretty near up. He has been evicted from New York, slapped around badly, outgeneraled badly at Long Island and then at Kipps Bay on the East River shore of Manhattan Island, and then, you know, he doesn't do all that well at White Plains, and then he makes a terrible tactical mistake in leaving the garrison at Fort Washington near what is today Harlem on Manhattan Island. That garrison, in the course of 4 hours, 3,000 men are captured or killed. Most of those who are captured who go into British prisons will die in British prisons. And then the British steal a march on him and attack Fort Lee across the Hudson in New Jersey. And then he's in full retreat across New Jersey, heading for Pennsylvania, westbound across the Delaware River. His army is down to 3,000 men. This is a country of 2.5 million people. No wonder he thinks the game is pretty near up. The British are on his heels. It's not clear how this is going to end. It's not even clear that he's going to be commanding general after this. People are beginning to have serious doubts about him. So, there's a reason for us to feel despair as we're trudging with them across New Jersey.
The enlistments are going to be up. People are just melt. The army's melting away. They don't have enough to eat. They're in rags. He's writing to a Congress. You know, we think of the United States today being this place of endless resources and money. We can create anything. But he's writing a Congress that has no power, no money, no ability to do anything for him.
That's right.
And it makes you wonder. I wondered as I read it. Why didn't he just throw it there, or, you know, throw it all down and walk away?
Yeah, I think that's a good and ultimately unanswerable question, because the reasons vary. In the case of individual soldiers, I think an infantryman is an infantryman is an infantryman, and from the days of Thucydides, they fight, they stick together, they adhere because of each other. There is something about the camaraderie of combat and the camaraderie of soldiering that really gives them a sense of comradeship and a sense of commitment. And it's a commitment not to a cause per se, but to each other. So that's a dynamic that I think is very important. It's certainly the case today in the military. They do have a sense of what the country they're trying to bring into being can be. They have grand aspirations. They're very aspirational. And they have a notion in Washington, and certainly among them, that if they are successful, that this is going to be something that will leave the world just gobsmacked, that they don't quite know what it's going to look like. They have vague ideas of a republic. They have vague ideas of a continental power. They know that what we today call California is out there somewhere. They know it's a continent. They know they call it the Continental Army. So they have ambitions, and those ambitions help to get them through some very dark days. Some of them are doing it for money. The Army over time will become less the farmer in New England leaving his plow in the furrow to grab his musket and go off in defense of liberty, and the Army will become increasingly composed of men who are immigrants, who have trouble finding jobs, who are single, who have no real roots in the community, or they're not married, they don't have families, and so on. The complexion of the Army, the socioeconomic construct of the Army is going to change pretty considerably over the course of the war. We have to understand that. It's not the same Army that exists in 1775 at Bunker Hill, where it's not even yet the Continental Army. It's basically New England militia. When we get to 1779 here in Savannah, for example, that's a different army than the one that's been fighting earlier, the one that Washington is leading to the north. It's a different army. So today in counterinsurgency doctrine, there's a term, human terrain. You have to understand the human terrain. If you're going to conduct a counterinsurgency in Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam, you have to understand the human terrain. The human terrain in America in 1775 is really complex. It's very, very complicated. It includes probably about 1 in 5 of the 2 million white Americans are loyalists, active loyalists. 500,000 of the 2.5 million souls who live in the 13 colonies are black slaves, who have absolutely no interest in the, you know, the aspirations of their white masters, other than to the extent to which it can alleviate the misery of their lives. And you got a large, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are fence straddlers. They just want to stay out of the way, or when the American army is in their backyard, they tend to be patriots, and when the British army is in their backyard, they tend to be loyalists. Mm-hmm. They will go with the wind, understandably. And so this this human terrain is a real complex thing. It's one of the things that makes, I think, the story so interesting.
Are the statistics good enough to know? For instance, we know in Vietnam the average age of the soldier was 19, I think, in World War II. I think it was 24, 25, something mm-hmm. like that. Do we know what the average soldier, if there is such a thing, looks like in the revolution?
Demographically, probably not the same, because the records aren't nearly as good. We know that about 200,000 American men served in the military in some capacity during the eight-year revolution. Again, comparing that to 16.1 million in World War II. But that's 200,000 in a country of 2.5 million. Mm-hmm. We know that, as usual, war falls hardest on fit young men. They're the ones who can stand up to the rigors required of soldiering in winters like Valley Forge, and even harder winter at Morristown, 1779-1780. Mm-hmm. We know that there were a fair number of old men, old meaning 50, you know, which was ancient in those days. I mean, you can look at Washington's officers and get some idea what the officer corps was. You know, it was everybody from Henry Knox, a 25-year-old overweight Boston bookseller who just happens to have a genius for gunnery and engineering, and he'll be the father of American artillery. Nathaniel Greene, buried here in Savannah, Rhode Island anchorsmith, a Quaker. I think he was 34 when the revolution began. These are relatively young men. Washington is 43, I think. Let's see, born in 1932. So I think he's 43 when he takes command of the Continental Army. He seems like the old man at the age of 43. Mm-hmm. Of course, the average lifespan is so much less than it is now.
And Lafayette, even though he's not in your story yet, he'll be 19.
He's 19. He's 19 years old. He's a very immature 19. He's a fantastic character. I'm spending a lot of time with him now, looking forward to bringing him into the next volume. You have an army that is, today we think of enlisted men, privates going into the army, being 18, 19-year-olds who are looking for college money. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a fair amount of that in the Continental Army, but then there are also older guys who, again, are looking for work or whatever reason they've thrown in their lot. So it's a mixed bag, and it's hard to put together a portrait of the average soldier during that eight-year period.
Let's talk for a moment about the people who were leading these soldiers. We're going to play this game, overrated, underrated. I'm going to throw a name out. Yeah. Tell me, really quickly about your impressions of who these people, based upon your research and writing, and what you think about them in terms of their reputation.
Yeah.
We'll start at the top with George Washington.
Yeah. I had the privilege, Stan, of living metaphorically with Dwight Eisenhower for 15 years, writing about him in World War II. He's with me from the very beginning to the very end. And over the course of those 15 years, I came to admire him more and more. And I'm feeling the same way about Washington. I think he is the indispensable man. That's a cliche, but it's a cliche that's true. He's the indispensable man leading the indispensable institution, the Continental Army. You know, when he shows up at Cambridge in early July 1775, he's had 5 years of experience as a colonel in the Virginia militia. He's been out of uniform for 17 years. There's a lot that he never knew about cavalry, about continental logistics. And there's a lot that he's got to learn. And one of the things he's got to learn that's most interesting to me is he leaves Mount Vernon, and he's leaving behind a couple hundred slaves to take care of business for him while he is away playing soldier. He gets to New England. He gets to Cambridge, and he is commanding a largely New England force. He is a Virginian, and it's a deliberate decision by Congress to put a Virginian in command of a largely New England force as a statement of national unity. He doesn't really understand what it's like to be a yeoman farmer who's left his farm and his wife and his kids, or a shopkeeper who's left his shop to go off and serve at his side. Washington, is very dismissive and disparaging of New Englanders. He has nothing good to say about his junior officers. Privately, he's really quite disgusting. It's going to require him to understand the sacrifice that these men are making to serve at his side in the same cause with him, and for him to build the mystical bond between leader and led that is so critical in successful military enterprises. And he does that. I mean, he eventually gets it. And watching him learn as he's going along, learn about, you know, he's got a stack of books about military fortifications, and so he's got books with him. You can see him in his tent at night by candlelight, looking how do I build a flesh, or how do I build fortification? You know, how do I do this? How do I do that? Because for one thing, he's got to be his own staff. When he shows up initially, he doesn't have a staff. He's got a couple of aides, and the Congress will eventually provide him with a quartermaster, but he's initially his own clothier general. He's his own intelligence chief. He will be his own intelligence chief all through the war. All of the staff positions that are critical to running an army, Washington's got to do it. He is really down in the weeds. And so watching him master that, he's got a brain organized for executive action. He's got an adhesive memory. He's very articulate both orally and in writing. He's very impressive. He reminds me a lot of Dwight Eisenhower in a lot of ways. Not a particularly good tactician. Doesn't see the battlefield spatially and temporally like a great captain, Napoleon or Ulysses Grant does. But he's got extraordinary capacities for work. It seems like he never gets sick. For 8 years, he's got luck, the trait that Napoleon most appreciated in his generals. Washington is lucky, like Eisenhower. George Patton said that the initials D.D. Eisenhower stood not for Dwight David, but for divine destiny. There's a bit of that with Washington, too. So all this is a very long-winded way of saying I think that he's really an extraordinary guy. He's not overrated. He's going to learn how to be the general he needs to be, which means I'm not going to risk my army. If I lose my army, the game is up. I'm going to do what needs to be done. I'm going to learn how to do that, and I'm going to learn how to hold together this very fragile thing called the Continental Army. So I'm looking forward to spending another 10 years or so with him.
I'm going to ask you about Nathanael Greene.
Yeah.
John Furling said that Washington was indispensable, but at any point, particularly later, if he had fallen, if he had been killed, if he'd gotten sick, as you just mentioned, the one person who probably would have led the Americans to victory, no matter what post-war looks like, forget that for a moment, is Nathanael Greene. You agree with that?
I do. I think that, but that is later.
Yeah.
Of course, the war moves to the South, and the last couple of years of the war is entirely in the South. Except for Arnold's treason in the fall of 1780.
Right.
It's just skirmishes in the north. And Greene is the critical guy. He is the one who's holding it together. Now, early on, I mentioned the catastrophic mistake of leaving that garrison at Fort Washington on Manhattan Island. That's Greene's mistake, first and foremost. Greene is the commander on the scene. Washington's relying on his assessment, and Greene just doesn't see how vulnerable they are. That, you know, in fact, this is a terrible idea, leaving them there. It's a trap. And Greene writes a very poignant letter when that garrison is captured to his friend Henry Knox, saying, gosh, if I ever needed a friend in life, I need one now. You can just see but he picks himself up. He writes to Cottie, his wife. His correspondence is really interesting. And he says the Americans are put to a trial. Be of good courage. Be of good courage. I mean, you know, you can see him collecting himself and saying, okay, drive on. I made a mistake. I'm going to learn from that mistake. I'm going to be everything that General Washington needs me to be. I'm going to be everything that my men need me to be. And so, yeah, he's born to lead other men in the dark of night, and that's a valuable capacity. Again, he's got a brain organized for executive action. He will be made the quartermaster general. He says to Washington, nobody in history has ever heard of a quartermaster. I really don't want to do this. I want to be a battle commander. Washington says, I really need you to do this. Our supply system is in chaos, and it's collapsing, and you know how to run things. And so he does it. He salutes and says, I'll do it, and then he will go back to battlefield command for that last great act of the war. So, yeah, I agree with that entirely.
I would ask you about people like Hamilton and Lafayette and John Lawrence, but they're not here yet. They're not on the scene. They're coming in the next volume.
That's right.
So I want to just ask you about Charles Lee, who is in this volume.
Yeah.
Underrated, overrated? What do you think about this
guy? Oh, he's just such a wonderful character. I mean, I love writing about Charles Lee. I like writing about Patton. I mean, Charles Lee was a British military officer, like Montgomery, mm-hmm. Resigns his commission. He's become a lieutenant colonel. He's a little disaffected with the way things are in Britain. He's a very odd character. He looks odd. First of all, he's spindly. He's got no shoulders. He's got a huge nose. He collects nicknames, and the most unkind of them is Nazo. He loves dogs. He's always got a pack of dogs following him around. And he shows up as an emigre in 1774 and begins to, he's a radical. He really is a radical. He's a revolutionary at heart. And once he's out of British uniform, his full, you know, Trotsky heart comes into play, and he's a good writer and an inflammatory writer, and he gets a lot of attention as we're leading up to war, and he cuts a wide swath, and he meets a lot of important people, and when the war starts, he's got substantial experience as a British Army officer, including combat experience. They make him a major general, and he becomes Washington's deputy. He is second only to Washington in terms of the hierarchy of the Continental Army. He's critical to Washington. Washington admires him and trusts him a lot while recognizing that he's very idiosyncratic and that he's got eccentricities, including the dogs and all the rest of it, the odd uniforms that he wears. But Washington relies on him because he knows things about running an army that Washington really is learning as he goes along. He relies on him for tactical advice, too. He has a couple of good moments. He shows up in Charleston. The British Army, British Navy arrives in June of 1776, and they're going to burn Charleston or conquer Charleston. It's not clear what it is because they haven't decided what they're going to do. But at Sullivan's Island, in one day, the Royal Navy is defeated. Now, Charles Lee is the commander on the scene. It turns out that the South Carolinians, the militia, and the Continental Force that's there have well in hand. And he's smart enough to let them fight.
Under Colonel Moultrie, right?
Under Colonel Moultrie. And they do a brilliant job. Brilliant job of defeating the greatest navy in the world, inflicting a lot of casualties. And anyway, Lee is celebrated as the victor of Sullivan's Island. He gives full credit, it has to be said, to the South Carolinians who do the fighting. But he, when he arrives back in with the main army up north, he's really riding high. And then he gets captured. He does a foolish thing as he's coming to join Washington's main army as part of that sad retreat across New Jersey. He takes shelter one night in the middle of December 1776 at an inn in north central Jersey, and a British cavalry patrol gets wind that he's there. They know who he is, of course, because he's out of British uniform now. There's a question of whether they'll hang him when they catch him, and they capture him. And he's going to be in jail in British hands, in custody, for a year and a half. He's off the stage. The capture of General Lee is an incredibly dramatic story. It's a fabulous story. So we're going to come back to Lee in the second volume because he's going to be exchanged. And then he's going to reveal himself for who he really is. We're going to see. And that's the thing about war. It really is a great revealer of character, the incredible stress of combat. It flays people open. You see who they are ultimately. And that will happen in spades with Charles Lee.
On a hot June day in 1778, right?
That's
Monmouth.
Right. Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. A million stories in this book that I could ask you to talk about. Briefly, what is the chronological framework for the next two volumes? Where will the next volume take us in terms of chronology?
Well, volume one ends with the two battles in Trenton and then the Battle of Princeton. Princeton is early January of 1777 when American hopes, which had seemed really on the verge of desperation, were on the verge of desperation, are revived. And Washington takes his army into winter quarters for the rest of the winter of 1777. So the volume two will open with the fighting season starting again in early summer of 1777. And it will, I'm almost certain I'm going to end it with Charleston in May of 1780. American army there, 5,500 men. They are trapped at Charleston. There's a siege. The British actually are very deft. They've learned from Sullivan's Island, and they're mad about the repulse at Sullivan's Island. In June of 1776, General Clinton, who had been at Sullivan's Island, is back as the commander on the scene, and they're going to lay siege, and they're going to capture that entire army. It's 5,500 men. Captured at Charleston. You know this story very well, Stan. It's a calamity of the first order. At this point, Georgia has fallen back within the British Empire. It's no longer a state. It's back to being a colony.
That's right.
South Carolina, now the low country of South Carolina, is controlled by the British. They're moving into the up country. It really doesn't look good, and they're headed next for North Carolina, and they're going to roll up the colonies from the south. That's their strategy at the time. So I'm almost sure I will end it there. You know, just as an aside, I see an epilogue in London the next month in June of 1780. There's something called the Gordon Riots that occur. It's the worst civil disturbance in Britain in the 18th century. Mm. Riots go on for days. They're anti-Catholic riots, actually, and then they're just riots for the sake of rioting. And there are 800 people killed. The king basically has to take command, George III. It shows us, even though the British are, you know, ostensibly riding high because their battlefield successes in America are finally beginning to pay off, and yet, boy, I mean, what is going on in England at the time? And then the third volume will pick up sometime in the summer of 1780. Benedict Arnold comes into his own, not as the great battle commander that he is in volume one.
He's one of the ones I wanted to ask you about.
Boy, I mean, talk about being born to lead other men in the dark of night. Benedict Arnold is an extraordinary, probably the best battle commander on either side in the first 2 years of the war. And but then, of course, he's got issues. Yeah. And so those issues we'll see in full flower. He's been badly wounded at Quebec. He's wounded again at Saratoga. He's nursing grievances. He's very unhappy. He marries into a Tory family in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he's gonna flip. He's going to be the traitor. So I may open Volume 3 with Arnold's on the verge of committing the most horrendous treason in American history as commander at West Point, where he's going to sell the fortification. He's going to sell West Point, which is the linchpin of defenses on the Hudson. And, we'll take it through Yorktown. The war doesn't end at Yorktown in the fall of 1781.
Right.
It's still pretty nasty. It's a low-intensity conflict, but people like John Lawrence, one of the most brilliant young men with a extraordinary future as a leader in America, he's killed in one of the last skirmishes of the war. He's basically the last man to die for the cause. And the Treaty of Paris in 1783 will bring it to a close. So I'll get out of it somehow. I'll figure
it out. Are you going to take it through Washington's resignation in December of 1783?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
I've already been collecting string on that. It's such he leaves New York. New York has been in British hands since 1776.
Right.
It has been recolonized basically, and then Washington comes in with his staff, and they have a final farewell dinner. It's very poignant. It's very very powerful, and he says farewell, and he lays down the sword. George III gets word of this. The story is told by Benjamin West, the American painter who's become a court painter, and is a good, I think, a reliable source, and George III says basically if it's true that he's giving up power voluntarily, then he's the greatest man on earth. And it is true. He gives it up. And, I see that as a good natural stopping point.
Well, it's a terrific story. The book is... I predict a Pulitzer Prize for you again, Nick. It's fantastic. Congratulations on its publication. Continued good luck in the writing in the future. I know it's a big task, but I can't wait to read it. And thanks so much for coming on our podcast.
Well, thanks. I'm so grateful to the Georgia Historical Society. They've been good friends over the years. I love what you're doing here, and it was a pleasure to be with you, Stan.
Thank you.
My thanks to Rick Atkinson for joining us for this interview. You can find out more about his book, The British Are Coming, at revolutiontrilogy.com. The hardest working engineer in show business, the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS bog snorkeling team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our GHS director of media manipulation and free elections is Patty Mayulipsolong Maher. The GHS Playground Director, Staff Archaeologist, and Fearless Food Taster is Elise, Are You Gonna Eat That? Butler. Our GHS Coordinator of Classroom Indoctrination is Lisa War Eagle Landers. The GHS Maven of Social Media and Library Science is Sabrina Human Search Engine Saturday. Our GHS Efficiency Expert and Controller of German Names is Karen Bodenschatz-Zollner. The director of the GHS Russian Literature Division is Christy Maple Crisp, assisted by our writing intern, Warren Pease. Our Off the Eaten Path fact checker is Ella Fino. Our staff airline reservations manager is Will Price Randomly. Our GHS hair color consultant is Dewey Ardoni. Our staff rock and roll historian is Bruce Wade Hughes. And our Off the Eaten Path martini mixer is Oliver Twist. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone and on Spotify. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Be sure to like Off the Deaton Path on Facebook and Instagram as well. Please also visit deatonpath.georgiahistory.com and check out Dispatches from Off the Deaton Path, my blog, and similar revolutionary podcasts like this one. Stay safe, stay strong. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. As always, thank you for listening.